Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman. In episode 11, season 1, I spoke with James Ennis, the internationally renowned violin soloist. In this conversation, you'll hear him talk about his mentors and teachers and the way he learns and prepares music, different recording projects, programming, his chamber music projects, and he also gave some great advice for musicians generally. All of these episodes are also in video format, and the link is in the description. Good morning, James Ennis.
Good morning.
I hope you're a violinist who doesn't need any introduction, but you're really famous the world over as a concert violinist. And I believe you just put out your 59th recording.
That sounds possible. Yeah, I've sort of lost track of the numbers at this point.
I was looking on your website actually this morning and counting. I was like, one, two, like I knew you'd done a lot and you're relatively young. It's very impressive. So this is a very special recording you made a year ago. Can you tell us about that project?
I'm not exactly sure what you're talking about because I've released two recordings. Okay. Within a couple of weeks that are both kind of interesting stories in that they were, I guess, pandemic products, and the logistics of putting them both together were kind of unusual. The solo recording of the Izai 6 sonatas for solo violin, that was something that, that was completely unexpected, not planned at all. But last year, when things were breaking down, concerts were all getting canceled, I was here in my home. And, that things were falling out of the diary, like day by day by day. And there were a few of the European festivals, Prague Spring Festival, the Dresden Music Festival, those two in particular. I'd been due to play at them, I guess it would have been late May of 2020. So maybe in April, they said, well, we've canceled the festivals, but if you'd be able to create some content, maybe you could film a performance of yourself, and we'll play it on our channels and we'll give you a little money. And having nothing else to do, I said, yeah, sure, I can do that, no problem. I do that all the time. Of course, I'd never ever done anything like that before. I had no idea how I was going to do it, but it was like the one thing we all had at that point was time. So I thought, well, surely I'll figure this out. So with the help of a great friend of mine, a wonderful producer who's produced most of my albums for the last many years, a man named Simon Kiln in London, he and I got talking, and he made some recommendations of maybe, investing in some proper equipment, nothing that was going to break the bank exactly, but some nice stuff that could serve me well in terms of recording myself. We didn't know how long things were going to be going on like this at this point, but we figured it could be a while, and it's not a bad thing to have the capacity to record oneself. So I got some mics and an audio interface, and downloaded a program on my computer and just started the process of figuring out how this all worked. Now in my house, very fortunately, we built this house not long ago, and built a room, kind of a big central room, where the idea was if we kind of cleaned everything out of it, took out the furniture, took up the carpets, that it could really sound quite nice, have little house concerts, and it does sound quite nice, and it actually sounds really nice. So we stripped the room, and I started recording samples and sending them to my friend Simon, saying, oh, what do you think? Am I doing this right? Of course, at first I was doing it all completely wrong, and but we worked on kind of refining, mic height and distance and placement and just all of that sort of stuff, placement within the room. And eventually we got to a point where he said, it sounds really good in there. Like, it sounds as good in that room as in any studio that you're going to find. I think you could actually do some serious work in there if you wanted to do that. And so I thought, well, okay, this is an interesting idea. So I ended up filming some of these programs for these festivals that I'd mentioned, and learned through that process how to film myself with an iPhone, and just really just what we had in the house. I mean, I did spend a bit of money on the mics and the audio interface, but the filming part, it's like I think I spent like $60 from Amazon for a couple of like the cheapest tripods they had and little connectors for phones. And I mean, it was really on a shoestring budget, but between this camera we had in the house, just like an old, you know, SLR camera, and my iPhone and my wife's iPhone, we had this nice three camera setup. And so I made these films for the festivals. I thought, you know, these are not bad. And so then I enlisted the help of, it's a long story. You sorry you asked yet? My wife and I got in touch with a filmmaker friend in London, and he was saying, oh, well, you know, you can do this and you can do this. And there's this app for your phone that gives you full manual control of this. And, you know, maybe you can buy a really cheap, like stage light, you know, go Amazon again, like $29 or something. So we set up for some sort of proper filming, and I ended up recording all of the Bach sonatas and partitas and all the six Izai sonatas for these filmed recitals. I called them my recitals from home, and I sell them on via my website. They're on Vimeo, and that was an enormous project. I mean, it was one of those things that now the music business has by no means recovered, but it's recovered at least to the point where now it seems just unfathomable that I could have spent so much time on this one project. But I'm glad I did. And I knew that the audio could eventually be used for, because, you know, it was all recorded in high resolution and all that. So it could eventually be released as albums. So yeah, the Izai sonatas from the recitals from home, those were, you know, mastered for CD and released quite recently. And the Bach is going to come out later in the year. But the other album that just came out is the first of four CDs of Beethoven quartets that my quartet recorded. And that was another crazy adventure, because we had booked about a week to spend in England recording with Simon, who I already mentioned. And as this was booked for last August, and as the summer went along, it was clear we were not going to be able to get over there. He was not going to be able to come over to us. But none of us wanted to scrap it. We were like, well, you know, we've worked so hard, and we'd been playing cycles of the Beethoven quartets over the last several years. And it was the right time for a project. You know, sometimes that's just how it is. It's like the time is now. If it's not now, it's not going to happen. So, you know, the amazing modern technology. So Amy, the other violinist in the quartet, she runs a sort of an elite music school in Macon, Georgia, the Robert McDuffie Center for Strings at Mercer University. And Mercer University has a really lovely concert hall that happened to be free at this point in August, because school was not yet in session. And so Amy booked us into there, and her husband, who is a drummer, percussionist, amazing guy, also is a recording engineer. And so he, on the ground in Macon, Georgia, managed to coordinate a broadband stream to Simon in London, who was monitoring the sessions in real time at like 48K. And I mean, it was amazing. So we had Simon's face on a Skype call on a computer. And yeah, so he produced these sessions. So the first CD we ended up recording, oh, that was another nice thing, because we didn't have to fly all the way over to the UK, and we didn't have to fly all the way back. So that actually gave us, I think, about four more days in the recording schedule. So we had originally been thinking we would record two CDs, Beethoven quartets, and we got started, and it was like, well, let's just keep playing until we run out of time. We ended up recording four CDs. So we recorded everything from Opus 74 to the end. And the first CD of Opus 130 and 133, that was just released. And I think we just approved the master for 127, 131. And I think we're just waiting on one of our members to approve the master on the 74 and 95.
Wow, I was going to ask you about the quartet. I haven't heard you yet, but I'm going to buy those recordings. Well.
Yeah, hope you like them.
So how do you manage it in a normal year when there's no pandemic, or, you know, we hope we've gone through the worst of this at this point? What with your touring schedule so intense as a soloist with orchestras and recitalist, how do you manage to have a quartet?
Well, the quartet is really, it's been, I'm trying to think of how, when we sort of formally established ourselves as a quartet maybe 10 years ago or something.
Oh, okay.
We're all really old friends. We've known each other for years. I mean, Amy, the other violinist, she and I went to summer camp together back in like 1989. So, you know, it's like our families are like family. And, mm-hmm. and the cellist, Edward Aaron, he and I were suite mates at Juilliard back in the 90s. And I think a lot of quartets, I mean, playing a quartet is hard. And in a lot of ways, and I think it's a sad reality that for a lot of quartets, it becomes so immersive that there's a certain amount of personal distance that mm-hmm. develops and that is required. You know, there's all these famous stories about, you know, four members of a quartet yeah. in four rental cars and taking four separate flights and staying in four yeah. different hotels. And you know, I think that's not. That's not always the case, of course, by any means. But our quartet is kind of the opposite because we would get together to hang out anyway. Mm-hmm. That was kind of how the quartet got started, is just kind of the idea of some projects where we were eager to do the projects, but just as eager to get together and just hang out. So, you know, sadly, our real life has set in for us, which is in that our violist Richard O'Neill eventually was like, I think I want a real job with real stability and real, you know, and so we were thrilled. Richard took the position with the Takash Quartet. So that was another reason why these Beethoven quartets, it was like, well, this either happens now or it doesn't happen at all, because Richard was joining the Takash Quartet and moving to Boulder and being in residence there at the mm-hmm. University of Colorado. And it was, you know, this was a wonderful chapter in his life. But it, so for the last 10 years or so, it's basically been finding any pockets of time where our calendars line up and getting together and cramming like crazy. And everything about it has been difficult to the point of being, you know, unrealistic and nearly impossible. And that, I think, has kept our motivations for doing it extremely pure because, you know, none of us are doing it for any other reason than we just really, really want to, because, you know, it is always involved like just these ridiculous things. It's like, well, you know, let's see, if I took an overnight flight from Los Angeles to New York and then we rehearsed all day and then I played a concerto with the Philharmonic at night and we could rehearse during the second half and then we could fly to South Carolina and perform it the next day. And it's like, that's a terrible idea, but we would do things like that mm-hmm. just because, you know, it was fun. And then I'm the artistic director at the Seattle Chamber Music Society, and we have two festivals a year, one in January, one in July. And that often was a time for us to sort of be more properly in residence together, mm-hmm. You know, learning some repertoire and spending a little bit more time. So it's hard to know what the future of the quartet is, because it's just hard to think about it without Richard. But yeah. But you know, it's funny. We thought that this was going to be, you know, something we would really have to figure out for this season, the 2020-2021 season. But then, of course, everything was canceled. So it's like, oh, we don't have to make that decision. So what we ended up how's this for like kicking the can? We were like, well, how about this? How about we play string trios, where Amy plays violin and I play viola and Ed plays cello? So that's we've been doing some of that this mm-hmm. summer.
And you just mentioned the Seattle Chamber Music Society. So when this is released, that will be going on online. And I believe people can stream those concerts until September 13th.
Yes, I think that's right.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about any of the rep you'll be playing there or people you'll be working with?
There's so much. It's funny. I'm this was lucky planning. I've got all my my planning stuff right sitting on my desk here. It's hard to keep track of because, you know, you plan one festival and then by the time you've sort of got those programs put to bed, you're thick into the next one. So I have been thinking like, okay, what is on these programs this summer? Because I haven't thought about it for a little while. But I shouldn't I would like to spread whatever credit there is, but I should at least accept blame for the programs myself, because you know, that is my job. And what I like doing with programs, and this applies to my chamber music programs, it applies to the recitals I play, or really whatever, is I like variety, you know. So mm-hmm. I would like to think over the course of a season that that people can see some sort of recurring themes, or you know, they can feel like there's a value of experiencing an entire season. And that being said, though, I think it's a shame when somebody goes to a concert. You know, concerts are, well, I mean, our streamed concerts are cheap. They're very inexpensive. But during normal life, you know, you go to a concert, it's expensive. You know, tickets are expensive, and you know, maybe you've got to go into the city and park your car, and it's a whole thing, right? And I feel like it's a little bit unfair sometimes when you go to a concert and you feel like you've received one piece of a puzzle. You're like, I don't know quite what to make of today or tonight. So I think that one of the challenges of programming a series is making every, you know, for lack of, our concerts are usually at night, so I'll say for every night, make that night a special night, a special mm-hmm. night, and a complete night, and a whole experience, and a wonderful experience. But also for the diehards, you know, the people that are really in for the whole season, that they sort of get additional context and additional kind of depth to what's going on. So, there's a lot of variety in our programs, and I one thing that I've really focused on with the streaming concerts is there's a certain focus on was happening in Leipzig, you know, in the middle of the 19th century, and just what an incredible time that was when you had the Schumanns and you had Mendelssohn, and you know, there was just this incredible atmosphere of music making. And with this chamber music that is often so intimate, you know, as we've been filming our last couple of festivals, I've realized that the way that people experience music on a screen is very different than in a hall. And of course, one of the great joys of chamber music is it is, I think, for the listeners as well as the performers, a very intimate kind of interactive experience. And so there's an exploration of that intimacy with these filmed concerts, you know, playing music that you can, of course, you know, the music is fantastic because you can adapt it to your circumstance. And yeah, I mean, you can play the Schumann last violin sonata or the third piano trio, you know, you can play these in concert halls and you can make them work, but to have them in your living room with close film work and all that, mm-hmm. I think is maybe a little bit closer to the essence of the music. So we're having some fun with that. And you know, I always try to throw in some interesting new music. There's actually a great friend of the National Arts Center, Jocelyn Morlock, has mm-hmm. Written a wind quintet for us this year, which is we commission a piece annually, and very, very happy that Jocelyn could write this wind quintet for us. Stuart Goodyear is coming down, and we're playing some of his music as well as him performing on the piano. So there's great stuff, and yeah, I hope our viewers today might be interested in checking out the series at mm-hmm. Seattle Chamber Music, seattlechambermusic.org.
It'll be linked in the description. Yeah, as along with your website and everything. I wanted to follow up on a few threads that came up so far. I have to say, when I heard you play Izai Balad first time was an encore when you were with our orchestra in Southam Hall.
Oh, wow.
And it was completely unexpected for us. Maybe you'd planned it. We're like, what? You know? And then, you know, I heard you play it in your concert, recitals from home. Ooh. And the sound you achieved, it was just unbelievable. And such a different experience, you know, because I've always heard you when I've been in the orchestra, and I don't normally see you, right? It's just like your back's to me, and I'm appreciating your tone going out into the hall. But this was such a different experience. And also your Bach, because I have your first CD that you put out quite a while ago, like almost 20 years ago now.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful you'll be releasing this new set as well. For non-violinists, they may not realize we practice solo Bach. We learn, for me, it was like every year, you're always as part of what you're doing is solo Bach. Was that also part of your upbringing?
I mean, I was always, I think really kind of all through my student years, I was always I was pretty much always playing something of Bach and something of Paganini. Mm-hmm. I think just as a way to I mean, what better ways to train the hands really than mm-hmm. those two composers? So yeah, Bach has always been, I mean, I think that so many violinists during the shutdown of the last year and a half, I mean, so many violinists turned to Bach because it's mm-hmm. it's like, for one thing, you know, what better music to turn to? For another, of course, it's something that is complete for a solo instrument. You know, so much of what we do is kind of part of an ensemble or a duo at least. And so to be able to play music that is sort of the greatest music there is, and that is self-contained, complete as a solo instrumental thing. And then also, I think that, you know, as you said, it's like it, for violinists, it's kind of part of our history, part of our lives. You know, it's been, Bach has been, I think for most violinists, a constant since early days. So yeah, it's always great to come back to Bach. And it's funny, there was a period of time, you know, I made that recording a long time ago. Yeah, I think that was about 20 years ago, more maybe, and 22 years ago or something. And I think it was probably close to a decade, maybe between say like 2004 and 2014, that I just got really lazy. There were like three of them that I played all the time. Mm-hmm. I played the second and third partitas and the first sonata all the time. And the other three, I just kind of didn't play, just because, you know, when somebody needed Bach, it was like, well, that one's kind of in my hands. And, mm-hmm. you know, then of course that becomes this kind of cycle that it's hard to break out of. And so I guess it was probably around 2012, 2014, I don't know, something like that, that I was like, okay, well, this is kind of ridiculous. And so I started playing, actually I got asked by a friend to do just the most ridiculous thing. You know, he was like, oh, can you come to my festival and play all the Bach sonatas and partitas like in a single night? I was like, no, absolutely not. I don't want to do that. And but he's a good friend. He was like, oh no, you should come, you should do it, you should do it. And it's like, oh, this sounds like a terrible idea. I'm not sure.
I can't.
So I did it and discovered that it's actually kind of a really nice way to experience that music. Like it sounds awful, right? It sounds like kind of punishing the player and like punishing the audience, but you can just kind of get into that world and just kind of live there for a few hours. And so that was kind of wonderful. So I started doing that in a bunch of places, and you know, either in a single evening or in two evenings. And it was around that time that I thought, you know, I think my thoughts and feelings on the music have evolved to the point where it might be worthwhile to re-record them. You know, old recordings, I feel like it's sort of like looking at old photographs. It's like you see them and you're, hopefully, if you've had a happy life, you see old photographs and you're like, yeah, I remember being that person mm-hmm. at that point, and that's a happy memory. But it's not necessarily who you are now. And so I guess, you know, I remember somebody putting on a recording of Bach at one point. I wasn't really listening. It was just sort of on. And I remember thinking that I really liked it, which was turned out to be a good thing because it was me. I listened to it and I was like, I really love that. I wonder who that is. And it was interesting is when I realized it was me, I mean, there's a funny story about Misha Maisky apparently hearing his recording, his first recording of the Bach suites, and getting really angry and being like, this cellist doesn't know what they're doing. This is, and asking the person in the record store, what is this terrible recording? And they were like, it's you, Mr. Maisky. And that's why he recorded them again. And so happily, I didn't have that experience, but it was more the experience of I don't really recognize that person anymore, even though like it was kind of a part of me. So all this to say that I thought, well, you know, maybe I should record them again, but it's like, well, that's a big undertaking. And when is that really going to happen? You know, and how am I, since I love to record with Simon, it's like, well, am I going to go over to the UK and find time and go into some hall? And how's this going to happen? So for this shutdown, it was like, well, that's easy. Of course, the thing that was kind of weird about it is that they were entirely self-produced. You know, I didn't have a producer listening in saying, oh, why don't you give that movement another try? Or what do you think of this and that? So I mean, in a way, I guess these Isai and Bach recordings are the most solo can be. Because, I mean, I didn't have any input from anybody, so for better or for worse.
And you were recording it from midnight till 4, I believe?
About that, yeah. It was, you know, I'm lucky. I live in a very quiet area, but still, you know, there's noise, there's lawnmowers, there's whatever. And we actually live along a river, so there's boats. and so between that kind of outside noise and realistically, you know, the inside noise of having a couple of kids and we're all locked in the house, there wasn't practically going to be any way to record during the day. The other thing is, since I was filming all this stuff, I wanted to have control over light. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that can be a tricky thing if the light is changing through the course of an afternoon. So yeah, we realized that the only way to do this really would be to record at night. So I would try to maybe go to bed at 7 or something, or 8 maybe, and wake up at 11:30 and have a cup of tea. And there was this whole list of things I had to do where it was like, okay, well, I'm going to turn off the breaker for the refrigerator so that doesn't hum. And I'm going to turn off the air conditioning, and I'm going to, you know, turn this light on to this level and this light on to that level, and make sure that all. And I'm actually, in retrospect, I'm kind of amazed that I didn't have a night that I, you know, recorded all night and got nothing, because like all these, there's a lot to think about, you know, making sure that all the cameras are running and all the batteries are charged and that you know, there's space on the hard drive, all these things. I think that I did enough dry runs to know what it was that I had to be doing, but also I think I got kind of lucky.
And as someone who, you're normally traveling a lot and dealing with time zone changes, so was that sort of putting you back in that zone of, you know, your body's able to cope with this?
I think the thing I was laughing about to some friends is, you know, my kids are a little bit older now. I mean, they're 7 and 9, so it's not like they're, you know, they're not big kids, but it brought me back to the days of when they were babies, where it's like, oh, well, you're just tired all the time. And, you know, I think that yeah, the, between the time zone thing and the being a parent, the fact is that you, as a performer, you know, if I'm on the road somewhere and people are like, oh, how do you deal with the jet lag? It's like, well, you know, if I'm playing concerts, I mean, the work that goes into it is the preparation. By the time I play a concert, it's like, if, particularly if there's no rehearsal that day, it's like I can be completely jet lagged because I only really have to be 100% on for an hour of the day, you know, and I can be a zombie the rest of the day if I need to be. So I don't know, I think that you begin to train the body a little bit into knowing that it's like, okay, well, I have to be on now. And I can collapse later. The recording days, I would record just one piece a night. Like basically, because I didn't have a producer, my process would be like, okay, well, I'm gonna record Bach C major sonata tonight. So, which was a daunting night, you know. Yeah. And I got up. It's like, well, I'll play it through. I'll play through each movement, you know, 4 times or something. It's like, well, you know, if I don't have it by now, then that's on me. You know, that's a reflection of my preparation, and I have to live with that. And so yeah, I would just kind of run through these pieces over and over. And you know, honestly, it was not psychologically, it was not a bad way to spend the time. I mean, we were all going a little bit crazy. And, you know, down here in the States where I live, I mean, there was at this time of year, I mean, it was not just the COVID lockdowns, but I mean, all of the social fabric of the country was tearing apart. And to spend a few hours playing Bach was not a bad thing mentally. You know, yeah. it sort of helps get my head together a little bit.
That C major is just amazing. And that fugue, 3 parts. I played that for my final recital at McGill, like the whole sonata, but no one had advised me that you should really practice doing a run through of the whole sonata, right? So I'd always practice each movement, and I got on stage and I thought, I have never actually played this through. So I always tell my students that, like, No matter how tiring it is, just do whatever the run is, right?
I remember the first time I played Brahms concerto and the first time I played Elgar concerto. It's the same thing. I got to the end of the fifth movement
Really?
and I was like, I was just completely done. And with Brahms, it was a funny one to say, I obsessed over that piece as a kid on the LP. So it was like, first movement is side A. And I would just listen to it over and over and over and over. And then eventually, I'd flip it over to side B. But yeah, that first performance of Brahms Concerto, where I got to the end of the first movement and I realized that the tank was completely empty and I had two very challenging movements to go. But yeah, that's a good point about the Bach. I think I find that. It's funny, one of the ones that for me is a funny one in that regard is the first sonata. It's not that it's terribly long, but the last movement is challenging. It's technically there's a lot happening there. And you can start to play sort of mind games of with it being in two parts, each part repeated. So it's like, okay, you've gotten through the first movement, you've gotten through the fugue, and you're through the Sicilian, and it's like, okay. Got through the first half. Now I've got through the repeat of the first half, and you start seeing the finish line, and that's a dangerous way to play.
You'd mentioned Paganini before, that you did a lot of Paganini growing up. So you've recorded the Paganini Caprices a while ago. Do you think you would redo them at some point?
I recorded those twice too. It was
Oh, I'm sorry.
my first album that the first thing I recorded back in '95, I guess it was,
Okay.
and so that was Paganini Caprices, and then back in 2009, I think it was. I recorded them again, and I still mess with my wife with that. Like every once in a while, when I feel like it's been long enough that I can get away with it, I'm like, thinking I might record the Paganini. She's like, no. I mean, the preparation for the 2009 recording was intense. It was sort of like, I feel like I was like training for some sort of, the Olympics or something. I don't know. The thing that's a little bit, I guess, I know that with that recording in 2009, that I prepared for that as hard as I could, and I don't really, I haven't listened to it in, well, probably a decade, maybe more. Like, I don't know if I've ever really listened to it after I approved the master for release, because I was like it was too close. And I know I'm proud of what I did, and I know that what I did was the best that I could do at that point. There was no question of like, well, if my schedule had been a little different, or if I'd prepared a little more, or if I'd scheduled the sessions a little differently. It was like, no, that was what I did. That I feel like I can hold my head up high because I did it right, the way I would have wanted to. And so in a way, it's like I kind of don't want to listen to it because it's been 12 years. Surely there will be things where I'm like, I wish I'd done it this way instead, or I wish I'd done it that way instead. But realistically, I don't really play a lot of those pieces anymore, which is kind of too bad. But the music business has changed, and I've definitely witnessed the way that things change as a soloist gets older. The type of repertoire that people ask me for is very different than what they asked me for 20 years ago. So I don't know. I don't anticipate that I will record them again. I would like to think that I'm still young enough that I could do them as well as I did. But if I'm not going to record them in the next 10 or 15 years, when I'm 60, I know I won't be able to play them the way I did when I was 30. So I don't know. But it's too bad that that music is not appreciated, perhaps more by the intelligentsia, than it is, because I think Paganini was a wonderful composer. I love the first violin concerto. I think it's a fantastic piece. I think it's super fun. It's really entertaining. It's beautiful. It's dramatic. It's funny. And I don't think I've been asked to play it in like 10 years, because it's like, oh, well, he's in his in his 40s and we'll have him play Brahms or Beethoven. And it's like, what am I going to say? Like, if someone asked me to play Sibelius concerto, I'm going to be like, no, you know, of course I'm going to play it. I mean, that's why I do this. I love it. But it's funny, like, I remember one of the first pieces I played with the National Arts Center Orchestra was Wieniawski Second. Mm-hmm. Great piece, fantastic.
Beautiful piece.
I mean, 20 years. I think it's been 20 years since anybody's asked me to play that piece. And actually, I know Joshua Bell, last year, a couple years ago or something, he just made a point. He's like, I'm gonna play it. And he just basically told orchestras, he's like, I wanna play this piece. And they said, really? He said, yeah. I said, okay. So he did. And I thought, well, that's great. Good for him. Because, you know, sometimes there's this, I don't know, there are certain sort of delusions of grandeur in our business. And I think that, you know, nobody loves Bach and Beethoven and Mozart more than me. You know, I mean, I put myself in that category of people that you know, kind of worship at the altar of these great masters. But I think that there's room for music that is also just kind of entertaining. Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it feels like a lot of programs these days are just so serious. You know, it's like, it has to be, you know, some, you know, there has to be some, you know, B composer, Bach or Beethoven or Brahms, and, you know, the most serious of that. And then, you know, maybe a contemporary piece with a social context. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's like, this is all great. Like, yeah, of course. But, you know, it's a bit of a shame as a violinist that we have all of this music, you know, that doesn't really get played all that much. And so I'm kind of excited that actually that I don't think that any of this has been released, but the next time that I'll be playing with you will be some sort of more fun pieces. So, mm-hmm. Looking forward to having a little bit of fun.
I remember a friend of mine had done master classes with Milstein. Mm-hmm. And his requirement was that everyone have 2 Paganini caprices in their back pocket in case he didn't like the piece you chose to play from that day. He'd say, I don't want to hear that.
That's, wow. Yeah, that's...
old school, right? Can you imagine?
That's super, super old school. But, you know, I think, honestly, if more violinists were kind of growing up that way today, I think it would be a good thing. It's like, you know, I meet all these kids that, you know, I'll come across some like 16-year-old kid who's like playing the Baird concerto. And I'm like, yeah, have you ever played Zigeuner Weisen? And they're like, Zigeuner what? I haven't heard of it. No. And it's like, well, that's too bad. anyway.
So let's talk a little bit about your youth and your training, because you come from a pretty small place, Brandon, Manitoba. And then I know you went to, well, you, in your own words, why don't you talk a little bit about?
Sure. Well, yeah, I grew up in Brandon, Manitoba, which is a great place. I feel lucky to have grown up there and had my family there for many years. My father was the trumpet professor at Brandon University. My mother had been a ballet dancer. That was actually how they met. My mom was dancing and my dad was playing in the orchestra. When my parents moved to Brandon, she was opening a satellite school for the Royal Winnipeg Ballet. So they were Americans and moved to Brandon, Manitoba, thinking, oh, this, you know, this could be an interesting place to live for a couple of years. And they ended up staying there for almost 40 years. And Brandon University School of Music is a remarkable place, and you know, particularly at that time when I was growing up there, it was, I mean, I don't mean particularly in contrast to what it is now. It's a remarkable place now. It's just, you know, I obviously I don't know it as intimately as I did then, but it was a really incredible assortment of just amazing musicians that had been brought in. You know, it was. The whole idea of the Brandon University School of Music was really quite remarkable, that starting from the 1960s, this amazing man named Lorne Watson, he started bringing in world-class musicians, I mean, people from all over, to create a school of music that was sort of the Canadian equivalent. I think of it as kind of the Canadian equivalent to like what Indiana University did in the States. where it's like, sure, you know, you can go to Montreal or Toronto or, you know, any number of cities and kind of immerse yourself in that city environment. And, you know, that's what I did. I went to New York and it's like, I understand the value of that. But I think there is also a real value for the right type of student to go to a smaller place where there's an enormous amount of individual attention, very few distractions, you know, and you can kind of immerse yourself in that musical life. And so the violin teacher at Brandon University was this legendary man named Francis Chaplin, who was fortunately my dad's best friend too. So my dad would never have had the nerve, I think, to ask him, you know, oh, were you listening to my little boy play? But there was a woman named Lise Elson. Do you remember Lise Elson?
Yeah, I met her, yeah.
Yeah, and she came through Brandon. She heard me play when I was little. I don't know, I think I was 8, maybe you just turned 9 or something like that. And she called Francis Chaplin and said, oh, well, you know, you should listen to this boy. So I was extraordinarily lucky at this young age to be studying with the university professor, who was quite incredible. I mean, up to that point, I had been studying with his students. So I had sort of this rotation of violin teachers, because, you know, I'd study with one and then they'd graduate, I'd study with another and they'd graduate. But anyway, so with Francis Chaplin and, you know, there were some of the other members of the music faculty that were like my musical family and my real family too. I mean, my pianist and piano teacher and kind of coach and overall guru man named Donald Henry and Lawrence Jones and these people, they took me under their wings and it was an extraordinary environment in which to grow up. And you know, there were other kids from my town that, you know, went on to extraordinary things as well. Like, I mean, it was not just like, oh, I kind of, you know, people, they're like, oh, you're from Brandon. Well, that's so unlikely. What are the chances of a violinist coming out of Brandon? It's like, well, I mean, two of my best friends there ended up, you know, one plays in the orchestra in Stuttgart. The other is one of the concertmasters of the Metropolitan Opera. You know, it's like, this was not an isolated thing. This teacher was a magician, and the whole society was so nurturing and fostering of what we did there. Anyway, so my teacher, Francis Chaplin, had been a student at Juilliard in the 50s. And one of his classmates was Sally Thomas, who he got in touch with Sally Thomas. And at one point when I was in my early teens and sent me away to Meadowmount to study in the summers at the Meadowmount School of Music, where Sally Thomas still teaches at Meadowmount. I mean, it's gone virtual the last couple of years, but she has not missed a summer in, I think, 75 years or something. Just absolutely unbelievable. You know, she went as a, maybe 70 consecutive years. Mm-hmm. She just had her 90th birthday. Anyway, so I went to study with her in the summers and then continued on, you know, I sort of, you know, followed in my teacher's footsteps and for university went to Juilliard and continued studying with Sally Thomas there. So yeah, in a way, I mean, I've had a lot of influences, a lot of tremendously influential people in my musical life, you know, between, you know, father and this man Donald Henry I mentioned, and various coaches here, there, and everywhere. But really, my only two main teachers of any kind of length of time were Francis Chaplin and Sally Thomas, and they were students together with Ivan Galamian. So in that sense, there's sort of a tradition, I guess, to the teaching that I've had. But I think in retrospect, two of them. The most remarkable qualities of both of these teachers are that they don't do sort of a paint by number approach. They actually gave me an enormous amount of individual freedom. And they gave that to all their students. You know, I remember being at one of Sally Thomas's studio classes where just by chance, it was like three kids that night were all playing Chausson Poème. And it was so interesting to me that in contrast to basically what would have happened at almost any of the other studios at Juilliard, where they would have all been just like cut from the same cloth, the performances were all so different, you know, different bowings, different fingerings. They were tailored to each individual student. And they, Ms. Thomas gave her students, you know, I think of her teaching being sort of like, you know, you release a horse on a track, and it's a wide track. There are fences on either side, you know, where if things start going a little off, you know, they will go down that path, but they can find their own route. And I think that was a very valuable thing for me and really for all our students.
That's a really cool image, actually. That's neat. I've heard you talk about your preparation, which it really resonated with me, that when you have the luxury of time, you'll prepare a new piece to about 90% and put it on the shelf and come back to it.
Yeah.
Which I think is so valuable. I was curious, that 90%, does that involve memorization or still with the score, if it's something you're going to memorize?
I think it depends. Probably with the score. Mm-hmm. I find that it's like, I'm sure it's this way for many people. It's that last, whatever you want to call it, 10%, 5%, that that's the hardest part. Particularly when a piece is fresh, and for whatever reason, you know, the mind is an amazing thing, and there is a certain amount of work that continues, mm-hmm. Almost subconsciously. And I've come to recognize that, you know, there will be certain things when I'm learning a piece where it's like, you know, this is going to be better, and it's going to clarify if I just let it sit for mm-hmm. a little bit. So yeah, I do, when possible, like to learn a piece and not get too worried about getting it to that very highest level. You know, I don't need to get a performance ready and then bring it back. Mm-hmm. And I just find like bringing pieces back in general, just, it helps so much, you know. Mm-hmm. I feel grateful that the way my career developed, allowed me to rotate a lot of repertoire as a young person. Well, because there was never kind of a moment for me where all of a sudden I was thrust into playing. You know, I didn't win some competition that then was like, oh, you've got 90 concerts next year after having like three the year before. That, you know, not saying that that can't work for certain people, but for me, it was such a gradual sort of buildup. And that every season I could program something new. I could make a point of programming something new. So that piece got sort of added to my mm-hmm. collection, so to speak. And then the second time you bring it back is easier. The third time is easier still. And the fourth time is easier still. And so I feel lucky that happened, because it allows me now to rotate a lot of repertoire, because there are a lot of pieces that are, you know, if you think of the brain as sort of a file cabinet, there are a lot of pieces that are permanently near the front of that file cabinet. So, you know, honestly, like, you know, sometimes the rotation of repertoire can get a little bit silly, you know, like packing for this summer. Yeah, just a stack of music like this hot. I'm just like, okay, that's a little excessive. But when it comes to, you know, I think it's a little bit limiting to be in a position where it's like, well, I'm playing Tchaikovsky for this concert, so all the weeks around that have to be Tchaikovsky. And, you know, there are some of my colleagues and friends that they prefer to sort of do that. They prefer to live in that world and kind of immerse themselves. But for me, it's like, I want it to, I guess I need it to be a little bit more special, you know. So yeah, I don't want to ever play a piece more than 2-3 weeks in a row. It just gets, I feel like it's impossible for me to be as excited about it by week four as I would need to be. You know, I'm always going to practice, no matter what piece it is, no matter how well I know it, I'm going to practice it, because I feel like that's my job. And the day that you don't is the day it doesn't go well, you know. So you have to practice, of course, but you know, if I'm playing Mendelssohn, well, I mean, like, for example, this just happened like a couple of weeks ago, or say I was playing Mendelssohn on a Thursday, and then the next Thursday I was playing Tchaikovsky, and there were some people that were like, oh, you know, should we coordinate this repertoire for you so it can just be the same piece for both? And it's like, well, if it's the same piece, I'm still going to be practicing every day. And honestly, like the amount of work that it would take to get Tchaikovsky performance ready is not more work than it would be to keep Mendelssohn performance ready. So what, you know, doesn't matter really.
Mm-hmm. When you're a student, like teenager and Juilliard, what was the rate of digestion of new concertos? I'm curious, like as a virtuoso coming up, how much repertoire was your teachers giving you?
Well, it's so hard to remember. Mm. I had a strong appetite. So I think that my teachers wanted to indulge that, I guess, or wanted to, I don't know, you know, work that to my advantage. Mm-hmm. So I learned a lot of pieces. You know, I was just kind of churning through a lot of repertoire. I've always had this kind of weird kind of collector's view of things too, where it's like, well, if I learn a Mozart concerto, well, I want to learn all of Mozart. You know, it's, I don't know, it's just part of my mindset. I don't know why I like collecting things or something, but so I was playing a lot of repertoire and Sally Thomas, you know, as I was in my, you know, later teens, she knew me. She knew exactly who I was from the beginning, and we've remained very, very close over the years, but she was so funny because she knew exactly how to push my buttons and exactly how to make me work. And so she would sort of casually throw out these sorts of challenges, like, oh, well, you know, I'd be at summer camp. It's like, well, you know, there's this open slot at this performance next week, you know, and we were talking about it at the faculty meeting. And, you know, I thought, oh, you know, if only it were a week later, because then Jimmy would have the time to learn the piece. But of course, it'd be impossible for him to do it on such short notice. And then, of course, I'm like, no, I can. And she knew what she was doing. So, I think that because of my personality, I think that my teachers saw the value in feeding me a lot of repertoire, as opposed to, you know, the value with certain students where you might want to really focus in and deal with these issues of refinement. You know, I think that you just have to know, you have to know the student and what they're capable of and what their own levels for refinement intrinsically mm-hmm. is, because, you know, I think that there are some students that they get a kick out of kind of 75% learning a whole bunch of pieces, but they never actually learn well. But then there are some students that it's like they get so bogged down where it's like, what, you went to university and you learned like three pieces in 4 years, you know, that's not great either. And that's not realistic, right? I mean, like, you know, obviously a job as an orchestral musician involves just such an unbelievable amount of repertoire. You're just constantly digesting things. And I think that sometimes I've seen, you know, with friends and kids that I've followed in more recent years, like this real rude awakening of the kid that spends, you know, their entire fourth year preparing their graduation recital, and that's all they do. And then they graduate and they win a job in an orchestra and they're playing more music in the first 2 weeks than they've learned in the last 2 years. And that's very difficult.
And it's hard. People don't realize orchestral music, it's often very difficult.
Of course, yeah, it's like super hard. And I think that sometimes like the orchestral violin parts, they're particularly hard because don't you find like some of the busiest stuff and most technically challenging stuff is not the stuff that you necessarily have in your ear from hearing performances of the piece. You know, I think about like I've asked for conductor friends' indulgences over the years to, you know, sit in orchestras and kind of play the repertoire. And I always think of like in Mahler symphonies, the hardest passages are often the ones that are really nothing more than texture. Mm-hmm. So you're not like, oh, well, yeah, I know Mahler 6 because I've listened to a lot of recordings of it. It's like the passages that you're going to work on the most are the parts that you've never paid attention to. Mm-hmm.
You are known for, of course, your beautiful sound and great musicianship, but also fantastic intonation. You just play so beautifully in tune.
Thank you.
But I wanted to ask you about that, because when you play with piano, it is different than when you play with an orchestra in terms of where the notes go. Mm-hmm. Or do you make those adjustments?
You know, I think that there's I feel kind of two minds about it. I feel like, to play with really good intonation, you have to adjust to the circumstances in which you're playing. And you know, there's sort of different kinds of intonation. You know, there's chordal kind of vertical intonation, and there's linear melodic intonation, where, you know, sometimes you hear quartets get into that sort of thing where it's like it's vertically lined up so well, but all the melodies sound a little wrong because it's like they don't quite fit right. And everybody in the group is like worried about, you know, where do I put the third? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm going to tune my C string up. And it's like, it just turns into this kind of craziness. So in our quartet, we laugh about this a lot, that sometimes it's just like, just play in tune, just play in tune, like just stop it, you know. Or the people that are like, yeah, well, you know, when I play with piano or I play with orchestra, and it's like, okay, yeah, but also at a certain point, it's like nobody plays that well tune. You know, no, nobody is really like. And also, we have the luxury of vibrato, right? Like, I mean, that the spinning of the sound in the air. So intonation is tremendously important, and I really appreciate the compliment, because it's something I think about all the time. And I mean, I think that, you know, one of the things that fuels good intonation is just being constantly paranoid about it, really. but I think that with intonation, I mean, really, I think a lot of when a person is playing, that one of the most important tools you can learn is objectivity, you know. Mm-hmm. And really trying to listen to oneself as part of the ensemble, or even if you're playing on your own, how does it sound? Not how does it feel like it sounds, not how do you think it sounds, not how do you want it to sound. Those are all very different things. And that's such a fascinating thing to work with students on, you know, because you know, we've all had these experiences working with these, you know, great, talented young people, where you see it, like you see it in their faces and you see it in their bodies, like what they're trying to do and what they're trying to say. And it's sometimes a very delicate conversation to be like, it doesn't sound like that. You know, yeah. You think it does because you feel it so strongly, but what's coming out is not what you're putting into it. And that learning the relationship between what you do and what comes out, I think is one of the, that's one of those, maybe the most important step, right? From going from student to professional. But I guess the other thing about intonation is, like, I think from a technical standpoint, I'm a big believer in hand position. Mm-hmm. Like, I want to always know when something goes well. I want to know why. And so I'm really analytical about the way that I play in a technical sense. Is I feel like the better I understand why something works, the easier it will be for me to replicate it. So in terms of having a very, very solid hand position and knowing the relationships between the different parts of the hand, you know, there are always parts of the left hand that are anchored in one way or another. Mm-hmm. And like how, you know, I remember just the other day talking to my nephew. This is an aspiring young violinist, and you know, he's just kind of learning how to shift. And I was talking to him about it, and more importantly to my sister, who's in charge of teaching him, about how it's not always about knowing where the note is. It's about knowing where the hand goes and how the finger fits within the hand. You know, and we all do that, right? It's like, you know, if you're shifting up to, like, you say you got to leap up to some high note, you don't always know exactly where that note is, but you know where the hand goes, and you know how the finger fits within the shape of that hand. You know, where it's like, I might not know where the G is, but I know where the E is, or, you know, something like that. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I guess there's a lot of thoughts, but anyway, I do appreciate it because it's something I think about. I don't like playing that's out of tune.
As an orchestral musician, we often have to find very high notes out of the blue, and we have to come in quietly, which is always a nightmare. I don't have perfect pitch, so it's like really a stressful thing. But it took me many years to figure out the extension of a sixth, because when you're up high, you can find a lot of notes. You know, you get to fifth or sixth position, and then, oh, if I extend a sixth, I know where that is. So that kind of geography.
Yes, exactly. That's totally what I'm talking about, where it's like, yeah, you might know where the bottom of your hand is. And because of that, you know how,
Yeah, so I just wanted to ask you, like, you have long-term relationships with certain musicians, and I was just listening to your, I think it's called Stream of Limelight, that Bramwell Tovey wrote for you, and you play it with Andrew Armstrong, with whom you've done so many beautiful recordings. Can you speak a little bit about those relationships?
Yeah, well, first with Bramwell Tovey, Bramwell, his first music director job in North America was with the Winnipeg Symphony. Mm-hmm. And Winnipeg Symphony was the closest thing I had to a hometown orchestra. I mean, by prairie terms, it was just next door, you know, only 250 kilometers away. And anyway, Bramwell, he came there in, I believe it was 89, I think. And my father for those years, for many years, was sort of the unofficial fourth trumpet of the Winnipeg Symphonies. They carried three, and if they had use of a fourth, they'd bring my dad in for Brandon. So my dad had a lot of friends in the orchestra that some of whom had heard me play. I think I'd played some school concerts with the WSO maybe in 1987 or 8. And they said, oh, there's, you know, this new music director coming to town, and, you know, you should have your boy play for him. And I was like, well, I don't know how to set that up. So his friends set it up, and we drove into Winnipeg, and it was just the greatest thing. I mean, you know Bramwell Tovey, and he's just the nicest man. I mean, he's so warm and wonderful, and he's a great musician. He's a funny guy. And anyway, he took me under his wing and gave me many of my early opportunities. You know, a lot of the kind of core repertoire, I feel like I broke it in under Bramwell's supervision, and we became great friends over the years, and I've had a lot of wonderful experiences performing together kind of all over the world. I made my UK debut with him, and so when I was doing this tour in 2016, it was my birthday present to myself. It was my 40th birthday in 2016. And I thought, well, you know, I want to go on a tour all across Canada, to all the provinces and all the territories. And, you know, not just because I think it can get to a point where just the nature of the music business, you know, I've been living in the States for a long time now. I'm married to an American. And at that point, you know, I was working with managers that lovely people, but like to them, I think Canada sort of felt like, well, Ottawa, Montreal, Toronto, Vancouver, maybe Calgary. Mm-hmm. When it was like, guys, there's a lot more to it in places that are really special to me and really important to me. And so I wanted to go not just to, not that I have, you know, it's always wonderful to be in the big major cities, but I wanted to go to, you know, places out in the Maritimes and places in the prairies and you know, smaller centers and a lot of the places that had really supported me growing up and been starting my career. So something I also wanted to do was commission a new piece for this and commission a Canadian composer. And so anyway, Bramwell, it was the most amazing thing. He wrote this piece as like a birthday present for me, and so yeah, that's Bramwell, and we've remained very close friends, and I always love seeing him and working with him, and just he's an amazing, wonderful man, and Andrew Armstrong, the pianist who was on that recording, who I've made a lot of recordings with, is he's one of my best friends and one of my closest collaborators. He and I've been friends for about 20 years now, and it's funny how it started. Like I'd always kind of heard about him through my student years, because he was this pianist from Connecticut that my roommate at Juilliard was a pianist. He introduced me to Andrew Armstrong at a concert one time. We were all at this concert at Carnegie Hall to see Rata Lupu play. He's like, oh, you know, this is Andrew Armstrong. He's beat me at every competition through my entire childhood. And so I knew he was, you know, this great pianist, but I really didn't know him well at all. And Andy called me, I remember this, in like fall of 2001. He was like, hey, you know, I've got this concert down in Miami, and I thought maybe I'd play a duo recital, and you know, I need to find a violinist to play with. And I mean, the whole thing was kind of weird. It was like, and I remember telling him on the phone, I was like, oh, you know, I'll have to check my schedule. I knew I was free. I was just like, this is kind of weird, this guy calling me up. And I got off the phone, and I talked to my girlfriend, now wife, and it was like, so this guy Andy called me, asked me to do some concert in Miami. And she's like, well, are you free? I said, yeah. So she said, well, do you want to do it? I was like, I don't know. I guess I've always kind of wanted to go hang out in Miami. She said, well, why not? So I went down and played this concert, and we just had the time of our lives. Like, the concert, I remember not very much about, but I do remember like playing like three sets of tennis on the concert day. And I remember drinking a little too much beer and eating some really good barbecue. And we just had such a grand time that that we ended up playing this same venue in Miami, like 3, 4, 5 years in a row or something, mm-hmm. until eventually it was like, you know, we could do concerts not in Miami. And we started, it's probably not until about 2007 or something that we started playing together a lot. And yeah, so just over the years, that's been a real joy, you know, kind of exploring the repertoire in great depth and detail with Andy, and you know, our families are very, very close, and you know, it's been a great pleasure. And he came with us for this Canada tour, so for large swaths of the tour, it wasn't entirely linear, but big sections, it was like me and Andy and my wife and my two young kids at that point in a minivan driving across the country. You know, it was a bizarre way to spend our weeks, but it was so much fun. And every year Andy and I are like, can we do it again? So I don't know, maybe when I turn 50.
Yeah. Well, on that note, I just want to thank you for today. It's been really, really wonderful talking with you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Nice talking with you too.
So all your many recordings and upcoming projects are all linked to your website, which will be in the description of this video. So thanks.
Thank you.
Season 1 of this podcast had 20 episodes, and season 2 continues with a really interesting mix of musicians talking about their lives and careers with perspectives on overcoming challenges, finding inspiration and connection through a life so enriched with music. Please follow this podcast wherever you listen to podcasts to be informed about each new episode.